This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 2003 was a bad year for the New York Times. Rocked by the Jason Blair scandal, he was the young reporter caught falsifying and plagiarizing stories, and by sharp criticism of its coverage of the run-up to the war in Iraq, the Times fell into an unusual and very public bout of soul-searching. Among the changes that followed was the appointment of the newspaper's first ever public editor. Other media outlets, including this one, use the title ombudsman, but the role is the same, a reader's advocate, or as Daniel Okrent described his job, a reader with an all-access backstage pass. After a long career as a writer and editor in magazines and publishing, Okrent accepted the appointment as public editor with what he described as a theological principle. "I believe the Times is a great newspaper," he wrote, "but a profoundly fallible one." Over the 18 months, he's addressed the dividing line between the editorial page and the front page, the use of the word terrorist, the publication of disturbing photographs, the use of anonymous sources, and a column that posed the question, "Is the New York Times a liberal newspaper?" And his reply, "Of course it is." Later in the program, what we're learning from the recent weeks of bloodshed in Iraq. But first, Daniel Okrent is on the home stretch of his 18-month stint as the public editor of the New York Times. His final column appears later this month. He joins us on the show today from our bureau in New York. If you have questions about his work and what he's learned over the past year and a half, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And Daniel Okrent, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. So in your view, is the New York Times still a great newspaper and still profoundly fallible?
Yes, I think so. It's certainly still great. And I think that the fallibility may be a little bit less profound now that it's been bruited about so much in public. But of course it is.
Bruited about so much in public. Obviously, the Times took some severe hits, certainly the Jason Blair affair and the run-up to the war in Iraq. The weapons of mass destruction, of course, were never found. And the Times' role in all of that was excoriated.
Right. And I think that I would change your verb. It's not that the Times took hits. The Times hit itself, really, in both cases. The Blair case, I believe, was truly anomalous. It was like nothing that had happened in the paper's history before. I think it's unlikely that anything of that scale could happen again. The coverage of weapons of mass destruction, I think, is a much more serious issue because it has to do with the way that journalism is practiced and not the behavior of a rogue reporter.
And have those practices changed, do you think?
I think so. I get a very strong sense in the newsroom that people really know what went wrong in the WMD reporting, and they want to be very careful that it never happens again.
Hmm. A recent study by the Pew Research Center has found that 14% of New York Times readers believe almost nothing they read in the paper. A panel that wants to advise the paper on ways to improve credibility released a number of recommendations. They're due out today. First of all, do you know what they've suggested?
Well, before I get to that, I'd like to comment on the 14%. I'm wondering who the people are, if they don't believe anything in the paper, why they bother to read it. I think there's some serious questions about the methodology of that poll.
Well, from the publisher's point of view, at least they bother to buy it.
At least they buy it, and they pronounce spell the name right.
Yeah.
The recommendations made today, I think, are very, very important. And I believe that the public way that they're being made with a rather lengthy article in today's paper really will go a long way toward making certain that they are put into practice. One of the problems, and this is not native to the Times, I think at any large media organization or any large organization, you can create policies, but enforcing the policies are difficult because you have 1,200 people doing their work every day, going in different directions. The thing comes out every day, and it's not always easy to get everybody lined up in a row.
Yeah, you can't take everybody out and have a week-long retreat and then say we're going to do it differently. You've got a paper to put out.
You got a paper to put out. Yeah, that's a real problem.
Yeah. I wonder, one of the things you also wrote in your first column was, what a great challenge it was to be the first editor ever public editor at the New York Times, but also that you could probably think of better ways to make friends.
Well, it's true. putting yourself in a position of criticizing people and trying to bring them, change their behavior is not a way to endear oneself. Not that that should be the goal that I would have had in the job, but the reporters have thin skin, editors have thin skin. They are used to doing the commentary on other people and looking into their lives. They're not used to having it done to them. They're particularly not used to having it done to them in the pages of their own newspaper by somebody who's never worked in newspapers. Early on, I did make a lot of enemies. I think I probably still make a lot of enemies, but people at least smile at me when I'm in the elevator because it makes for easier social discourse.
And they know you're leaving.
There's that, too. Yeah.
What about the readers? Tell us about them.
Well, the readers who came into my door, the many tens of thousands of them, clearly thought that there was virtue in this job. Although many came to say how I was a fig leaf and that I really couldn't accomplish anything, the very fact of engagement indicated to me that there was an interest in the papers getting better. The readers who mattered the most to me were the ones who clearly were disappointed in the Times, people who read the Times because they think it's important, because they do trust it. You get much more disappointed when your own child misbehaves than when the neighbor's child misbehaves. Mm-hmm. And these people, their regard for the Times is very, very high, which means that their capacity to be disappointed is also very high.
Our number, if you'd like to join our conversation with Daniel Okrent, the first public editor of the New York Times, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Let's begin with Adam, and Adam's with us from Seattle in Washington.
Yes, I've been reading the Times for about 10 years as a daily reader, and my question is the Times, it really writes the headlines for, you know, papers all across the nation. And I'm wondering, do you feel like your impact on it has improved it as far as its responsibility to the American people?
It's hard for me to say, Adam. I think that's for other people to comment on, whether I've improved it. I do think that there's a heightened consciousness in the newsroom about the paper's responsibility for precisely those reasons that you cite. It does set the news agenda in the country. And that the major contribution I'd say that I've made is that by the simple fact of having a column there every other Sunday, people come into work the following morning, and they argue about it. They may say that I'm crazy, that I'm nuts, I'm stupid, but they're engaged by these issues, and that's the important thing.
Well, there were a couple of specific recommendations that you made over the 18 months that you were there, including the idea that the Times ought to take more time, more space to explain to its readers what it is it was doing.
And in fact, that's one of the recommendations that this new committee issued this morning and very clearly endorsed by Bill Keller, the executive editor. And I don't know whether they did that because I said do that, whether my nagging had anything to do with it, but I'm very glad to see it happen. I think that the traditional newspaper or news media position of judge us by our work and not by what we have to say puts them in a position where they are going to be criticized and without a real right of response. And the right of response is something that we all ought to have in this culture.
Another thing that came out of the report today is yet another emphasis on the use of anonymous sources.
Right. And this has been my number one issue. And the reason why it's my number one issue is that from the email that I get and the phone calls and the postal mail, it's the number one issue among readers. There persists this view that when it says, according to a source who chose to remain anonymous, then fill in the blank, whatever the source had to say, that people don't believe it's real. They believe that the reporter made it up or that the reporter went looking around until he finally found somebody who would say it, even though the person wasn't willing to put his or her name on the record. And it's a real challenge to the credibility, not just of the Times. I think this is true in every newspaper in the country that uses anonymous sources that
mm-hmm.
way.
And what is the recommendation, as far as you understand it, to repair, diminish the use of anonymous sources?
There are two things. First, use them only when it's necessary. The way that I put it in my column yesterday is, you ought to have a little box with a glass door on it and a certificate inside that says permission to use anonymous source and a hammer and a little notice that says use only in the case of emergency. It's when they use anonymous sources toward no positive or important end that I really think that there's no excuse for that. Secondarily is when you do use them, and I think it's important if we're to know about what our government and various other players in our society are doing. Sometimes we must rely on whistleblowers who will not be public about it. Explain who the person is. Explain what that person's motivation is. It's not enough to say according to a congressional official. It should be according to a congressional official who is supporting the Social Security legislation or who wants to torpedo the Social Security legislation. Let us know the motivation.
And the Times did join with a group of other media outlets to ask government officials to stop using background briefings where a senior government official, usually senior government official, stands up and says something that they really don't want to attach to the name of the U.S. government in print, and everybody prints it.
It's really bizarre. It's a phenomenon where you're in a room with maybe 30 reporters from other news organizations. The person in the front of the room is, of course, known to those reporters and is known to his or her colleagues in government. Everybody knows who's talking except for, guess who, the reader of the newspaper, which seems a bizarre way of building trust with your readers.
Adam, thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to, this will be John. John's with us from Berkeley, California.
Yes, I'm curious as to why the New York Times doesn't print a lot of controversial stuff that I read in The Guardian, per se. The Bush administration was all for the parental rights in the Terri Schiavo case, but in actuality, Bush had signed legislation for termination laws in Texas, and was none of that was ever reported in any American paper that I saw, and I was just curious as to why the New York Times chose not to report on that.
Just let me say The Guardian, the British newspaper. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, it would be hard for me to say why in the case of any specific story unless I've had the chance to talk to people in the newsroom about it, and I haven't in that case. But there are a couple things that I think that may apply here. One is that the choices that are made by newspapers are human choices made by editors working under deadlines who have a lot of different things that they could put in the paper, and they pick this one instead of that one. The other is, and I'm not casting any aspersions on The Guardian here, I actually admire The Guardian a great deal, but often people will come to me and say, why wasn't such and such in the Times, and on further examination you find out, well, it wasn't true, and that's usually a pretty good reason to keep it out of the newspaper. As I say, I don't know whether that's the case in this particular instance, but that does deal with that does pertain in the case of a lot of criticism.
John, thank you. We're talking today with the public editor of the New York Times, whose 18-month stint is just about to run out. His last column will appear later this month. If you have questions for him, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, and the address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Daniel Okrent, who's almost at the end of his stint as the public editor of the New York Times. Other papers might have called him an ombudsman. You're invited to join our conversation. If there's an issue he tackled that you'd like to hear more about or one that you wish he'd taken on, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk now with Terry. Terry's on his car phone in New York.
Hello. Kudos on a most difficult job, sir.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could juxtapose the precipitous fall-off of liberal news outlets versus more conservative ones, Washington Times versus New York Times, CNN versus News, Fox News is through the roof, CNN is tanking, and evidently New York Times is had a huge fall-off of readership itself in the local area anyway.
Well, first, I wonder whether it's really fair to set them up as conservative versus liberal, though I've said that the Times is a liberal newspaper. I think in the sense that some of those institutions you cited, Fox News and the Washington Times, are truly committed to a conservative agenda. I don't think that's the case with the New York Times or with CNN being committed to a liberal agenda so much as kind of reflecting the liberal attitudes of many people who work on the staff. It's not... You know, I worry that the right-left positioning of news media has been something that's been well established by the right. If we are right, therefore everyone else is left, and that may not be the case. The Times' fall-off in readership in metropolitan New York, which is real, I believe is part of a national phenomenon, which is that newspaper reading is down. The paper did one really smart thing in the 90s by choosing to become a national newspaper and not stay primarily a New York paper. And in fact, today there are more people reading the paper outside of the tri-state area, the metropolitan New York, than in metropolitan New York. The other thing that pertains to your question is that the If you set yourself up as having a specific political agenda, you will attract people who have that specific political agenda. It's how many people are coming to your rally. So that by having a very clearly delineated, though they deny it, political philosophy, I believe that the Washington Times and Fox News particularly have attracted their own kind of contained audience.
It's interesting that in your column about is the New York Times a liberal newspaper, one of the things you were talking about was its transition from a New York paper to a national newspaper. And a lot of the things it covers in and around New York seem to somebody in Dubuque or Des Moines might seem like they're from Mars.
Yeah, I think that's the case, that it is definitely a reflection of the world that the people who put it out live in. And by and large, they live in the world of Manhattan, and Manhattan is not like the rest of the country. And consequently, the coverage that one finds in the paper reflects the attitudes of the people who live in Manhattan, the dinner parties they go to, the people they see on the streets. It's a very, very different place, and it's an inescapable part of the paper's makeup.
Terry, thank you. Let's go now to Larry. Larry's with us from Bellport on Long Island.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Hi. Yes, you know, during the Times has admitted, and it's kind of well known, that during World War II, because it was a Jewish-owned paper and they were worried about being biased, they underreported on the Holocaust.
Right.
And it's my feeling now that because they're being accused of so much of being liberal, that they're underreporting on issues that are very that would be critical to the Bush administration. It's just, and it's my experience of reading the paper that, God, for a paper that's being accused of being so liberal, they might as well be. And I find it very frustrating when I read articles in The Guardian or The Nation that I don't find in The New York Times.
Yeah, this is a point that a lot of people have raised. I think, though, that you have to make a distinction between what happened in the 40s. The coverage of the Holocaust was a very conscious the non-coverage of the Holocaust, a very conscious effort on the part of the people who own the paper to downplay this story. That's not the case today. Now, am I saying that it's not true what you're saying, that it's not reporting certain things because of the criticism from the right? No, I'm not. I do think that there's no question that you hear, if you're putting out a newspaper, you hear the shouting that's coming at you. I think there's a conscious effort being made to not succumb to that. I don't know whether it's succeeding or not. I'll leave that to others to judge. But there is no nobody is sitting in the corner office and saying, you know, we've got to be nicer to the Bush administration.
How has the phenomenon of email changed all this, do you think?
Enormously, both email and the blog world. It's just so much easier to make your feelings known. Also, it's easier for a few people to sound like a crowd. With email, Tom Friedman, the op-ed columnist, he's the one op-ed columnist who doesn't publish an email address. And I asked him why. And first, he pointed out that the time that he did, he got 3,000 emails in the first week. But beyond that, he points out that he will respond to anybody who sends in a letter. He says to write a letter, you have to get a piece of paper, you have to find a pen or a typewriter or put it through your printer, you have to find an address, get an envelope, seal it, find a stamp, walk it to the post to a post box. Whereas email, you can just write, tap, 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 I hate your guts, you lefty creep, you righty creep, whatever it is, and press the send button. It's become much easier for people to be intemperate and immediate in their criticisms.
Let's talk now with Amy. Amy's with us from Sebastopol, California.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask why there was a tremendous imbalance in your front page reporting in the lead up to the war in Iraq. Every time I read the front page of the New York Times, the articles seemed to propagate the war. I read a lot of Judith Miller articles, which later proved to be untrue. And I had to really read on the latter pages, 14, 15, 16, to read any other opinions that dissented against the war. I'm just asking, why was there that imbalance, and do you regret it at all now?
Well, first, I don't speak for the Times. I only speak for myself. I'm not an employee. I'm an outside contractor, and so I can't speak about regretting or not regretting. I also wasn't there at the time. And this really isn't fair for me to say, but I wrote a column specifically on this subject last May in which I went into great detail about why this happened. I think your perception is absolutely right. The Times failed to report that story correctly, accurately, with balance. And they did it for a wide and long variety of reasons. Primarily, I think it's this sort of sense that as the country is moving toward war, you can sometimes feel editors sprouting epaulets on their shoulders, that there begins to be this sort of momentum going in that direction. Additionally, many reporters and consequently the editors became captives of sources who were not giving them frank and honest information. That's one of the problems with anonymous sources. The paper did a really bad job then. And you can go on the website, the nytimes.com website, and find both its own explanation, its apology for it, which it published last May, and also the column that I wrote about it.
I've read that, and I just wanted to add one more quick comment, and that's that while I was searching for any other diversity in opinion, I was really forced to read, and in a way it turned out in a good way, but I started to read international newspapers. I found more articles with other opinions in the main newspaper for Mexico City, the Sydney Herald, the Guardian of London. I mean, I had to really look outside of the New York Times, where I had depended many, many years on fair reporting, and I was just utterly disappointed. I feel that there's not a good balance of reporting, even now, even after the fact.
Well, that's a different issue. I agree with you, and I think a lot of people at the Times would agree with you that it was inadequate back in late 03, in late 02 and early 03. I think it's much, much better now. Yes, there are stories that probably are not getting the play that one wishes they would, but that's always true, and it's somewhat inescapable, I'm afraid. That's the nature of the limited resources and the limited space that newspapers have.
Amy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's talk with Francis, and Francis is in El Dorado Hills in California.
Hi there. It's a rare privilege to speak to somebody who's got this august job at the New York Times. I just got back from London, where I was bludgeoned over the head by the notion that just about every newspaper you pick up is hopelessly and grotesquely slanted in one way or another. Even The Guardian I found to be a little bit appalling in that regard. I have two little questions. One is, do tabloids always cause people to read things that they normally wouldn't be thinking seriously about and just accept them? Because it seems to me that a lot of English papers in the tabloid format all are just ranting and raving from a right-wing perspective. And secondly, just one little statement. Thank God for the New York Times. That's all I've got to say. Bye.
Well, in behalf of the Times, although I don't represent them, thank you. I'm sure they would be very grateful for that. The British newspaper tradition, as most of the European newspaper tradition, is partisan. It is very specific. A newspaper represents a political party and its particular point of view. That's something that existed in America for the first 100 years of the Republic, but has really, to a large degree, disappeared. And there is at least the illusion that it's not representing a position, one or the other. I know that many people see the Times as representing the Democratic Party or the liberal position, and that may be true on its editorial page, but the effort is made, perhaps not always successfully, the effort is made in the news pages to not represent a party.
And I should say that if our caller was just in Britain, that phenomenon is even exacerbated during a political campaign, which of course was underway in Britain, so that might have been even more dramatic than normal.
And they also have left-wing tabloids there, too.
Indeed, they do. I did want to ask a question that the one issue the paper is struggling with is its coverage of religion. In a recent op-ed column in the Washington Post, John McCandlish Phillips, who's a former Times reporter, wrote that the Post and the Times are increasingly hostile to conservative Christians and that this problem exists throughout the industry. Is that something you looked into at all?
Yeah, but reading the Phillips column, and by the way, what a wonderfully written piece that was. He's such a good writer. He was talking about the opinion columnists. He was talking about Paul Krugman and Maureen Dowd, primarily, not exclusively, Frank Rich. He was not talking about the news coverage, and it's really important to make that distinction, even though the Times may make it difficult to make that distinction because, you know, one is not printed on a different color paper or comes separately from it. In terms of the news coverage, I don't think there's hostility to religion. I think that there's a lack of knowledge about religion. In a column I wrote last summer, I listed a number of groups that I thought really didn't get a fair shake from the Times because they were viewed as the other, and included among those groups were Orthodox Jews and devout Catholics. I think it probably applies as well to evangelical Protestants, although I think there's been a real effort on that front, for obvious reasons, to do a better job there. Reporter David Kirkpatrick particularly has done an excellent job getting into that world, and the recommendations issued today included more intense and thorough coverage of religion in this country.
Email question from Ross. Did your guest suggest that the paper expand its definition of diversity in hiring to include varying political views? The paper would be better served with an infusion of blue-collar and red-state employees from the top down.
I believe that deeply. It's on the one hand, though, you don't want to hire people because of their ideology. Let's go out and find a lefty, let's go out and find a righty. But you do want to have variety. So I think it has to do with the places that you're recruiting. You choose where to recruit, and if you're recruiting from a particular set of places, you're going to get a particular set of people. The other issue that's complicated in this effort to get what I would prefer to call intellectual diversity rather than ideological diversity is the recruiting is done from the newspaper industry. The newspaper industry is made up of people who generally have a certain, you know, there's a range, but there's a relative point of view. I talked to a former White House speechwriter who used to be a newspaper man. He covered economics, and he gave up. He said at the paper that he worked, the Detroit News, every article he wrote in which he kind of reflected a supply-side view of the world, every editor, he'd have to justify what he was writing before every editor, whereas a reporter coming from a demand-side description of the economy never had to do that. So they kind of disappear from the profession at times.
Our guest is Daniel Okrent, who leaves as the public editor of the New York Times later this month. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take a call from Mark, and Mark's with us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Neil and Mr. Okrent, I actually had a recent email conversation with Mr. Okrent and his associate, Arthur Bovino, and that's what I'm calling about. I see it kind of serendipity for hear Mr. Okrent on your radio show.
Mm-hmm.
What the email conversation was regarding, I had sent Mr. Okrent a couple of examples. One was something that I had considered at the very least, a news analysis and more tending toward being an opinion, but it wasn't marked as such. It was an article that was on the Washington page, and there was another article, international article, that was marked specifically as a news analysis. And I guess this goes to the point of the fallibility of the editors, where there isn't really a set of guidelines for determining what is a news story, what is a news analysis, and then what's an opinion piece. That it's all very subjective. I see Mr. Okrent's job is really is to help the reader become a better consumer of news. So that's what I was calling about.
Well, I think that you're making a very good point. And one of the things that came in the recommendation from this committee that reported this morning was something that I've been pounding the walls about for a while, which is a better labeling of those things that are not intended to be straight news. And they come under all sorts of rubrics. There's news analysis, Washington memo, political memo, a letter from Washington, whatever it might be. And one of the recommendations this committee made is that all of these things be labeled as commentary. So it's very clear to the reader that this is something that, though it may not be purely an opinion piece, reflects a particular take that the reporter has on the subject.
Mark, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
I did want to ask why, when you took this job in the first place, you insisted that this be 18 months and 18 months only. Why did you make that stipulation at the beginning?
Two reasons. One, I have other things I wish to do with my life. Three reasons. The second reason was because I wanted to be able to talk to you again, Neil, and I knew that I wouldn't want to wait any longer. But also, I think that when you're, you can't hurt a condemned man. A lame duck has a great deal of freedom and of authority. And so long as I had a space to write in the paper and the opportunity to speak to you and to anybody else I wish to speak about, then having a finite term guaranteed that no one would think, well, Okrent is saying these nice things about the paper in order to keep his job. Having announced on day one that I would be leaving at the end of May in 2005, I believe that would suggest to readers that I really was acting freely and without any effort to please the people who were paying my salary.
Will there be a second public editor at the New York
Times? Yeah, I just had lunch with him. His name is Barney Kalaim. He's a very distinguished newspaper man who spent nearly 40 years at the Wall Street Journal before his retirement just last fall. And today was his first day. We're going to overlap in the relay lane for 2 weeks, and then he takes over.
And in 30 seconds, what is it that you're going to be doing now?
In 30 seconds, I'm going to go home and not read email for a week or two. I'm going to sleep. I'm going to see if I can read the Times like a civilian. And I'll be beginning a new book. I'm writing a book about America during Prohibition, which was something that I had begun on before I took this job and then had to put aside.
Daniel Okrant's last book was a finalist for the Pulitzer.
It was indeed. Thank you. But say its title, Neil.
I think it was...
Great Fortune, the Epic of Rockefeller Center.
I knew you'd come up with it. As long as we're accurate, that's the main thing. Daniel Okrent, thanks very much. Good luck.
Thank you.
When we come back, Daniel Okrent leaving at the end of the month at the as the public editor of the New York Times. He joined us from our bureau in New York. When we come back from a short break, new tactics and deadly results of the insurgency in Iraq. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.